I don't have time to dabble in stuff. Like if I was going to get into this hunting thing, I didn't want to be waiting until September and be like, okay, I guess I'll go hunting now. It didn't make sense to me that I would be successful if I did that.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 158, and thank you for tuning in. As you'll hear in this episode, our guest is Levi Sim, and he is a newer hunter, but he has dove deep into hunting opportunity, not just in September, not just in the fall, or even for spring big game, but kind of all year, all species. We talk about hunting everything from marmot and coyotes to black bears. Levi has learned a lot as a new hunter about hunting small game, or sometimes what you might consider irregular game, and how he translates that into big game hunting is really fascinating. Along the way, we talk about his consumption of this game, yes, including the marmot and the coyote and some other critters that you hear about, and there's just a whole lot to take away from this one, as well as some of the lessons he's learned in general as a beginner, such as why you should never sit down your bow or unload your rifle while it's shooting light. Pretty crazy story there. Okay, so hope you enjoy this one. Wanted to remind you guys before we dive into the show about the giveaway that we're doing this month for some free nutrition consultation and planning from Valley to Peak Nutrition, as well as some free training programs from Atomic Athlete. If you want to hear more about that or get entered, go to exomountaingear.com/podcast. Hopefully you've done that already, but if not, you'll find the link to enter the giveaway. It's really easy. Make sure to check it out. Okay, here's this episode with Levi Sim. Levi, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark. I'm glad to be here. Let me throw out there too. I've listened to every episode at least once, and I appreciate all you guys have done for me getting started. So,
oh, well, that's cool to hear, man. Thank you. Yeah, it was fun. We actually got to meet in person back in, I think that was last April or May, at the BHA event there in Boise. And I remember we had just walked in the door before the event started. And we were coming to load in and set up the Exo booth and all that. And I remember you were there volunteering, and just, you were super eager, super upbeat, super willing to help. And I was like, this guy is like on it, super helpful. It was nice.
Yeah, no, it's, that was a fun event for sure. And, I loved, if nothing else, I can be a helpful guy. So
yeah, no, you certainly were. Cause even after that, like initial load in, I think a couple times throughout the weekend, you stopped by and I was like, hey, do you guys need anything? And so I certainly remember you from that, and just, was impressed with how helpful you were and how happy you were to be there and all that. What made you get involved with that, with BHA?
With BHA, actually, I first heard about it with you guys and with, and on the Meat Eater podcast as well. And then when I moved from Portland to Boise last, like a year and a half ago in October. And when I did that, it just seemed like a good idea to get involved with a group that had a strong local following, and I could start networking with folks, and, and they seemed like good folks, you know? Yeah. And so that BHA event was actually my first time. The rendezvous was my first time doing anything with BHA, and now I do everything with BHA that I can.
Yeah, so, that's awesome.
Like, I was at the Christmas party the other day. We missed you.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't make it out. I was bummed. I actually was just in Boise after that, and we randomly ran into Josh at the grocery store, and he's like, "What the heck, man? You're here now, but you weren't at the Christmas party."
Right.
So I was giving him trouble though, because he missed it, right? Because he was in Arizona hunting. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think I saw pictures of a large elk. Josh is the local
Yeah, Josh
organizer.
Koontz.
Yeah, for our local BHA group. So.
Yeah. Cool. So I want to, going back to that time, I remember talking to you and you had yet to go on your first big game hunt, but I remember your excitement about that. So here you are, you're at the BHA rendezvous, you're getting connected with BHA, volunteering. You hadn't yet gone on a big game hunt, and you started hunting obviously later in life then as well. What made you get started? Was it that move from Portland to then Idaho and getting exposed to it, or what was that like?
Actually, part of the move from Portland to Idaho was to hunt.
Oh,
Like
really?
I was pretty sure I was going to hunt. I'd gone out with a friend in Portland. We went and looked for turkeys one time, and then we went out looking for deer and elk. But I didn't have a weapon in hand for the deer and elk. But previous to that, like 2 years ago, this month, kind of, I picked up one of Rinella's books, the Buffalo book.
Hmm.
It reminded me of this time when I ran a buffalo meat company in Canada, and I was one of the plans I had at that time was to create hunts on these ranch lands that we had in Canada for in Alberta to hunt buffalo, and that didn't ever pan out. But it just kind of reminded me of how cool I thought that was going to be. And then, my grandfather was a big time hunter. He a self taught hunter and outfitter, it turned out. But I never got any of that with him. I don't know if I just probably lived too far away. My cousins hunted with him, but I never ever did. And so I don't know. I felt like I had guns in the cabinet over there. I might as well put them to use
Yeah.
and just got excited about it. And then I started walking in the woods, and it used to be that when I went hiking, I always wanted to go to a peak or a destination. Like the thing I hated the most was a loop trail, like walking around in a loop and not really going to a thing that was like a peak. And but then when I started doing these scouting walks in the woods, I realized that every spot was my destination because everywhere I am, I'm actively looking for these animals. And it just changed my whole perception of spending time outdoors, and
That's awesome.
I was just loving it. Yeah, I mean, you, I, have you been hunting your whole life?
Yes and no. So I hunted a bit when I was young with my grandfather, but didn't get super into it like I am now until later in life. So it was just kind of like one of those casual, like, hey, we'll do this a little bit here and there, but it wasn't, a real passion or pursuit like it is now. So, and then there for a while, like through high school and college, I was just, busy with sports and girls and stuff like that. And so I didn't for quite a while. But it was one of those things where right after I wrapped up college and then had, independence and free time again and all that, it really came back to it as something that I wanted to pursue. And that's when I really, really got hooked.
Well, I don't know if you remember the first time you found an animal because you were looking for it. I mean, I've been in the mountains all of my like teenage and adult years, and I've seen a lot of deer. I never ran into elk in the places I was. I ran into a black bear one time. And now, having been in those same places and just sat down and started looking for things, I'm amazed at how much wildlife I've never seen. And it's and there's it was so much fun to be out there looking for it and then seeing it because I knew what it was supposed to be doing. I knew where it was supposed to be at this time of day, and I knew the kind of place it was supposed to be because I'd been studying that. And to be there and to see them was just like so much fun.
Yeah, that's
And
awesome.
so, yeah. So let's see. Today's January 7th when we're recording, and January 8th last year, I killed my first non-fish, which was a chucker. Up in the hills down here near Boise, near in Nampa,
Yeah.
and it was a whole other fun thing too. Like I was really nervous because I shot it, and then it took me 45 minutes to find it. I didn't have a dog, and just that anxiety of killing it and not finding it. I don't like that.
Yeah.
I like to utilize the stuff that I kill for sure.
Right. Yeah, that feeling never goes away. That's still like the worst moments as a hunter is between the shot and the recovery.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So let's talk about that, because that is really interesting to me is, you know, you think of hunting, so much of our discussion is obviously on big game hunting, but you really dove deep. You went chukar hunting. I mean, you did some non-typical stuff, I would say, like killed marmot and coyote, all of which you've eaten. And so it's not just this story of, yeah, I started hunting later in life and I went on a deer hunt or an elk hunt. Like, you went pretty, I would say, vast in terms of species and just the hunting process. And so I want to hear more about that, whether it's the chukar. I definitely want to hear about the marmot and the coyote. But, like, what was that like to really just begin and to make the kill and then to consume that as a meal, you know, even before you got to big game?
It was like, I don't have time to dabble in stuff. I'm a full-time photographer myself, and so I'm self-employed. And I don't have time to kind of mess around a little bit with things because I'm probably also a workaholic, but I also enjoy time with my family and kids. And so, you know, I often stop working at 2 p.m. and take my kids hiking. But that means I'm probably working in the evening or on Saturday sometimes too. And so I don't feel like if I was going to get into this hunting thing, I didn't want to be waiting until September and be like, okay, I guess I'll go hunting now. It didn't make sense to me that I would be successful if I did that. and then trying to think of that too. Okay, it's September and somehow I did manage to kill a deer. Well, now what? I mean, I've got this animal, this enormous animal in front of me that I've got to get the guts out of and stuff. And I'm not squeamish, but you know, a fit like a 10-inch trout was probably the biggest thing I'd ever gutted before. Mm-hmm. And so just the experience of doing that to, well, I didn't end up doing it to birds. I'll tell you about that. But to a bunch of rabbits and a marmot and coyotes and all this stuff just gave me like the ability to stick my hands into a warm animal and pull their guts out without having any real trepidation about it. I don't know if that makes sense.
No,
but like
yeah.
Just practicing on small stuff made it a whole lot easier when I had a bear down in front of me on my own with nobody there. I wasn't like, I kind of knew what was going to happen. I was like, this is like a big bunny. Got to take care of it. I dove in and started going. I was like, I didn't quite have in-state residency yet, so I bought the small game license in Idaho for $99 and started hunting chuckers and rabbits. And I can hunt chucker through the end of January, and I can hunt rabbits through the end of March. And coyotes are unregulated, so except you have to have a license, but I could hunt those all the time. And then so end of March, and then I think bear opens on April 15th, so there's not a lot of time that there's not something I can be pursuing with a weapon in hand, which is pretty cool.
I just
dove in and planned to get after it.
That's awesome.
In fact, when I moved here, I started working at Cabela's. I worked at Cabela's for the holiday season in order to kind of be hanging around with people who like to hunt and networking with folks. And a couple of my clients are now good friends. Like a couple of people I sold boots to are now really good friends. And we go visit this one couple up in the hills near Idaho City. And then another guy I met there, I sold him boots for a trip to Canada he was going on. And it turns out that we shoot with the same cameras. And he called me up a few months later in February to see if I wanted to try filming a coyote hunt with him. And now he's my hunting buddy. And we go out a couple of times a month. So
that's great.
I don't know. It's been a whole thing.
Yeah. I'm curious with the small game. So you mentioned, obviously, it gives you this familiarity in terms of processing that game and after the shot. But what has it done for you just with the pursuit and like with your hunting instincts to translate small game hunting into big game hunting? And obviously there's differences among species and tactics and weapons and all that, but still you're still honing that pursuit of the animal. And I would just be curious to hear more about your experience with that, because I think there's a lot of us out there who probably overlook what small game hunting can do to help us grow as hunters in general, and how that might help our success for big game hunting.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't imagine a better thing to do than just to hunt all year, because you're training your eye to see game, for one thing, and it's highly elusive. Like, rabbits disappear quickly. They're pretty difficult to pursue. I'm not using a dog to chase them down. I'm walking through the sagebrush, and the sagebrush is up to my armpits. So if I see it, I mean, it's really dense. Like, I usually see it within 20 yards, well within 20 yards, probably 5 or 6 yards is typical. And then, and so it's training my eye. And then with chukar, they live on steep volcanic buttes. And there is no way not to break an enormous sweat chasing these things. And if you're going to go 1 mile after them, you might as well go 6 miles after them. So it's great training. And it is the best way to shed the holiday pounds as well.
Yeah.
And so the training, being out there, glass and stuff, like glassing for rabbits and ground squirrels is a lot of fun. And it's really the only way to catch a marmot as well, because they are extremely wary, the marmots, the rock chucks. And it's not like when I've climbed 14,000 foot peaks in Colorado, there's marmots all over the place, and they kind of come out, and some of them may be nearly tame enough to come up and eat out of your campsite while you're hiking, come close and eat your chips. The wild marmots are extremely wary, and you have to be at a distance to find them and shoot them. And then pattern them as well. You find the spots that they frequent, and you find out what marmot scat looks like, and you realize that they're always coming here, and then you realize that you've been walking by them every time you've come to this spot, and then you start sneaking up on that spot, and you see their little nose sticking up. Like, their body is sitting out on a rock sunbathing, and then they run away and hide. But their eyes and nose always come back and stick out in a different spot to watch you. And it's just been a ton of fun to try and see what these animals are doing. And just like deer and elk, figuring out where they're going to be, what they're going to be eating, and when they're likely to be available. And like, jackrabbits are killing me. Everybody goes out and goes bunny blasting, but eating them is so much more fun, and they're amazingly delicious. I've heard a lot of people talk about how they can't salvage jackrabbit, but man, the first time I cooked it, I used one of Hank Shaw's recipes for Sardinian hare stew, and man, it's delicious. And so much bigger than it's like an elk compared to a deer,
right?
A jackrabbit compared to a cottontail.
Right.
And so, I don't know. Did that answer any questions?
No, that's great.
Like, how do you, training in every way. You know?
Yeah. Where are you at personally? Just curious with, because you've mentioned, like, so marmot, you've eaten it, and obviously making use of the jackrabbit and even the coyote, you've eaten it. Are you personally at a place where you'll only kill something that you're planning on consuming? Is that where you fall personally?
Yeah, I'm not. I don't want to go out bunny blasting. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not fun to me. I'm not a woo-hoo killer. like I see on a lot of hunting shows, when I kill something, I don't throw my arms in the air and go, "Whoa, yeah." It's not how I feel about stuff. I do feel a responsibility for these animals. Like, I feel like a steward, and I don't mind killing as many ground squirrels as I like in the places where that's allowed. But I've eaten a lot of ground squirrels too. Excuse me. Part of it is wanting to consume the stuff that I kill, but part of it also is just debunking all the myths out there. Mm-hmm. Like, jackrabbits aren't good to eat. Coyotes aren't good to eat. Everybody's got, I don't know where it comes from, but a lot of people just have this stigma about various things and what they eat. My wife's uncle lives less than a mile away from us here, and he's been a hunter all his life. And he has no end of ribbing me about eating rock chucks and whatever else I'm after.
Yeah.
Because he basically, like, I guess he eats deer and elk. And I mean, I ate my antelope heart the other day. We made ticker tacos and it was amazingly delicious. And I was surprised he picked on me about that one too. It's in good fun for sure.
Yeah.
But there's just these stigmas about what you can and can't eat. And I'm really interested in breaking those down
right.
and seeing what the facts are. But especially, yeah, I'm just not into killing stuff. I'm definitely into eating stuff.
So you mentioned Hank Shaw, and he obviously has some amazing resources out there. What are the resources or go-tos have you found helpful for getting into some of this, the quote-unquote other game and making useful meals out of that? Or has it just been somewhat experimentation? What has that been like for you?
Oh, no, I definitely Google and look for recipes for things and then adapt them. Like there's a lot of rabbit recipes, but they're mostly like Hutch rabbits recipes. And they have a lot more, they're like, get a rabbit of 3 to 5 pounds. I'm like, man, I've got 4 rabbits here and it doesn't equal 3 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, just adapting the stuff that's readily available has been really good for me. Like when I did Hank Shaw's Sardinian hare stew, it's like a generous pinch of saffron is included in the ingredients. So I went to buy saffron, and a generous pinch cost $20
wow.
at Walmart. And I'm like, man, there's got to be a different thing I could do. So I did a little more research and found out that turmeric can be somewhat of a substitute for saffron. I'd still like to try it with saffron sometime, but not the first time I'm cooking a jackrabbit, you know?
Sure.
So just utilizing the internet has been really, really helpful. For instance, the first time I got 2 rabbits one morning, and I got back up to the peak of the valley where I got cell service again, and I looked up Stephen Ornella's method for gutting rabbits because that's the only thing I'd seen so far. So I used his method. It took me like an hour to clean these 2 rabbits on the side of the road, and then with a little more research while I was researching their habits and things, I found some videos. This guy in New Zealand goes, this is how you gut a rabbit, and he squeezes it and the guts fall out. And it's amazing. I don't know if you've seen this before.
I have not, but now I'm curious.
Oh, it's so cool. All you do is hold the rabbit up under the armpits and start squeezing hard and just working it like a tube of toothpaste.
That's what I was going to say, just like a tube of toothpaste, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, and about the middle, there's a pop, and then everything just comes out the anus, and it's the fastest, easiest way
really?
To gut them. Yeah, it's incredible.
Look that up.
Yeah, it's cool. In fact, I'm looking at a video right behind my Skype window here that I made the other day demonstrating it. So I'll send that to you.
That'd be great, man.
And then another tip for rabbits, because that first rabbit, I killed it like 4 steps from the car. So rather than carry it around with me, I just walked back to the car and set it on the ground. And it was cold. It was like probably 20 degrees. And when I came back to it, I picked up the rabbit. And on the underside that was by the ground, on his rear hams, on his rear thigh, there was like this black mass on there. It's like, what is that? And then it moved, and it was all the fleas that were on him.
Oh.
Had migrated to that spot because it was still warm.
Warm, yeah.
Yeah. And so ever after I shoot him, I just set him on top of a sagebrush to cool. Like I gut him like that, so there's, you know, most of the heat comes out with all the innards.
Uh-huh.
And then I set them on top of a brush to kind of air cool, and all the fleas evacuate while it's sitting there.
Huh.
And then on my way back, I just pick up my rabbits in a line.
That's a cool and, little tip.
Yeah, because like if you watch the recent episode, the recent new season on Netflix of the Meat Eater TV show, there's one in there where Steve Ranella kills a jackrabbit while they're grouse hunting. And he puts it right into his vest, and then there's fleas on his back is the next thing they show. And mm-hmm. like, I don't mind sticking my hands in a jackrabbit, but don't put fleas. That gives me the heebie-jeebies. So those things are cool. And so, yeah, I've learned a bunch of little things like that. That first chucker took me like 2 weeks to find the chuckers and then not miss. I'd been out 3 or 4 days before the 8th of January last year with a gun in hand trying to kill him. And I kept, I kept missing, finally get one. And then I call my uncle up, my wife's uncle, and say, hey, I just got this chucker. Can I bring it by and ask you what I should do with it? And he says, sure. So I go over and he says, nice bird, tells me some ideas. And then he says, hey, if you still got your gun, come in the backyard and shoot some quail. So it took me 2 weeks to get this chucker and about 2 minutes to get four quail in addition to it. And then I'd heard that people in Europe age their birds just like hanging up. And you've probably heard it where they hang them until they fall down, like their head falls off because they're so ripe. And then I found out that they don't even gut them to do that. They just hang them undrawn in a cool place. And so I tried it and I hung those chucker and quail for 3 weeks and I ate the quail along the way and they got better. They got more tender as the days went by. And so hanging those up in my shed for 3 weeks turned out to be a really good way to eat them. And then just yesterday I finished an experiment as well. I hung two rabbits for 3 weeks. All I did was squeeze the guts out and then hung them up. And it's cool. I mean, it hasn't been over like 45 degrees during that time. So, and they're enclosed. The only opening was the bullet holes. And so, those were the best bunnies I've had yet. They were super tender and just letting them sit for that time, allows enzymes in the meat to start breaking them down. And that's something I learned when I was running that Buffalo Meat Company. Actually, I had one client who wouldn't buy anything that hadn't been dry aged, hanging up in the cooler on the bone for less than 28 days. He only wanted it if it'd been hanging for 28 days. He's like, if it's any younger than that, my body just can't digest it. So it's a pretty interesting thing that you can just experiment with. So yeah, I don't know.
That's really interesting. It's always a different animal to try and age big game. Just because of space and things of that nature. But obviously with small game, that's a good way to kind of do some experiments there. That's cool. I got to hear about the marmot and the coyote. So what are go-tos on preparing these guys? Do you have any other tricks? What's the recipe? What's been your experience?
So starting with marmot, the first thing is that they're really hard to get. So I shot it with a 22. And so I've got to be within, like 50 yards. I shot it, I think, at about 30, finally. I missed it a couple of times before that, the same one on different days. I know a lot of people shoot them long range and blow them up with a 223 or something. Just they blast them. But the first thing to know is that their hide is so tough. I went through three knives just skinning the thing. And they're cool. Like they're just such a different little animal. They're in the squirrel family. They're a rodent. But they're so much bigger than like ground squirrels and bunnies. And I'd been out in the same area hunting ground squirrels, both for marksmanship practice and then just to try them out. Everybody says they have bubonic plague. Turns out it's the fleas that have the plague. And so if you use the air cooling method, then the fleas all evacuate. And I handle these things with gloves too. I mean, I wear latex gloves when I'm working on rabbits. Yesterday, one of the rabbits, had a funky looking liver and I hadn't experienced that before. I've heard of rabbits having tularemia, which is some kind of disease that they get, rabbit fever. And I don't want to get that. So I've always handled them with rabbits. Apparently you're able to see it in the liver. And this one's liver was like engorged and squishy and kind of yellow and blue looking. And I think that's what it was. So I took photos of that too, to share with folks. And so, yeah, everything I've been handling with gloves. Incidentally, people post often online when they're eating cottontails and they're like, what are these white strings in the meat? And people are always like, oh, those are worms, man. You gotta like, it's not going to kill you, but rabbits have, they're not worms. They're tendons. Those things are full of tendons. Mm-hmm. Just wound up springs ready to go. Anyhow, so the marmot, it is meaty and thick. It was like 7 or 8 pounds and it wasn't a big one. It was a smaller female. And so just a ton of meat on those relative to other small game. And what did I do? I think I did like a stew with dumplings that I heard about on, I think it was Hank Shaw's brief podcast that, or was it Jeremiah? Anyway, one of the wild game cooking podcasts I'd heard using canned biscuits to make dumplings. And so we tried that and it was good. It's a really rich meat. Mm-hmm. And a lot like a pork roast on the hams, just the way that it kind of pulls apart was a lot like pork, but definitely redder, a more red meat than pork. Right. And I don't know. It's pretty good. I should have browned it and then braised it, but I just braised it. And I think it would have been a little more tender if I'd browned it first. Mm-hmm. And then braised it. And just did it in the slow cooker for a few hours. And it was good.
Did you take a similar approach to the coyote or something altogether different?
Yeah, no, pretty similar. The first coyote I took, it was one that I was out hunting with my friend Nick, who's the guy I sold boots to at Cabela's. And he killed it. And we took the hide. And then I was like, I got to try this. So I took a ham is what I did. And I should have taken a backstrap. I mean, why wouldn't you take the most likely tasty meat? So, but I took one of the rear hams out, and all I did on that one as well was put it in the crock pot. Oh, no, I browned that first. I browned it in a pan of oil and just got a good sear all the way around on the meat and then put it in the crock pot. And it smelled really good. Like it just smelled like good meat for the first few hours. and then about the last half hour or so, there was just this weird kind of tinge to it. And I went down and I pulled out a fork and just took a bite that was kind of sticking up out of the juices. I can't remember if I put water in with it or something, but there was, you know, a bunch of juice in there. And that first bite was just like tasty meat. It just tasted good. And then I pulled off another chunk that had been in the juice a little bit and I gave it to my wife to eat and then took one for me. And she goes, this isn't good. And I said, what do you mean? And I took another bite and it was not good. The stuff that had been down in the juice
really
was not good. And I was like, that's weird. But I hadn't been particular about removing all the fat and silver skin and things.
Oh, okay.
And so the next one I shot,
some of that probably rendered down and yeah.
Yeah. And then just like penetrating everything that was in the juice got coated in it or whatever. And it's this weird kind of, I don't know, like some kind of like chemical-y kind of taste. Uh-huh. I lived in Taiwan for a couple of years and my mom sent me a package and it included some beef jerky and some Gold Bond powder. But she took the Gold Bond powder out of the package and put it in the plastic bag. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, shipping white powder
right. In
a box overseas, they're going to cut that open.
Yeah.
And so my beef jerky tasted like Gold Bond powder. And that's about kind of the taste. That's the only thing I can compare the coyote to. It's like this dusting of Gold Bond powder on the outside of beef jerky.
Which, so just in general, you wouldn't like replace flour in a recipe with Gold Bond. Like you're not suggesting that.
Maybe baking soda, but not generally.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
Your tongue tingles afterward. So the next one I shot, which I shot while bear hunting, I took a back strap and so I just kind of did a gutless method. I just opened the back on it. It was in May. So the hide on the coyote wasn't really worth keeping. It wasn't very dense or anything. So it wasn't really worth taking the pelt. And so I definitely wanted to take some meat. So I just opened along the spine and pulled out a back strap. And while I'm doing that, I could smell that same kind of odor that I know is not going to taste good.
Mm-hmm.
But while I sat there, I just removed all the silver skin and all the fat from that strap and then turned around and walked away 10 steps and smelled the meat and it had none of that odor left. And so I took it home and, I don't know, sliced it up and pan fried it. And it tasted just fine. Like it just tastes like meat when you remove all that stuff. Mm. And so what I'm finding is that all of these weird things that people won't eat, it's usually because they had one bad experience or they heard of somebody else's bad experience or Oh, you've probably read that joke. Yeah, here's how you cook a coyote. You take a cedar 1x6 and you season it and you boil it or whatever. You steam it and smoke it. And after 8 hours of smoking, you remove the board from the smoker, put the meat on a plate, dump the plate in the garbage, and eat the board. That's like the standard joke for eating all this stuff. And it's just not true. And so, I'm like the bear, man. So I killed a bear and it is the best thing I've ever eaten. And my wife agrees. Like, it's not just me. It was way better than the elk we've had in the past from other folks. It's better than everything else we've eaten. It was just sweet and tender and well cooked is another thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I almost equate it to, you know, maybe some of the guys who are hunters and like big game, but don't like the idea or some of their previous experiences with small game. It's almost like non-hunters with game meat in general. Like, there's been plenty of people who've had a bad experience with their uncle's or grandpa's deer meat or whatever. Right. And so they just think, oh, deer meat. Oh, but as hunters, exactly. We know it's like, well, it's in how you take care of it. It's in how you prepare it. And it can be the best stuff ever. And I think it's probably pretty similar, maybe even just a small game. It's, you know, maybe you've had a bad experience, but if you kind of try some things and take care of it well and do some things that, you know, accommodate the meat for what it is, then it's probably really good stuff.
Yeah. And it's so easy now. I mean, I can excuse my great uncle or my wife's uncle for not knowing some of this stuff, because when he was growing up and hunting and developing all of his skills, the internet was not available. You know, there were like three books in the library and there just wasn't this huge repository of experience from other folks. Like if you go to Cook Bear, a really great resource is at New Jersey's wildlife department, whatever it's called. And they have a recipe book for cooking black bear, and they've got a really tasty rub that you rub on the meat, and they tell you how to cook it well done slowly, because it's got trichinosis in it, so you got to cook it completely. And it was really delicious, which is funny because now they've suspended the bear hunt in New Jersey right now. So, but there's just so many options.
I want to get more into your bear hunt. One thing that I found really interesting, you know, your first big game was the bear, and it was actually over bait.
Right.
And there's still some, I don't want to say level of controversy. Sometimes there is about hunting bears over bait. Typically, if I throw like a big stereotypical net and think of someone who's later to hunting in life and doesn't fully understand baiting, I would say that they're going to tend to not be as interested in baiting for game. And so I find it really fascinating that your first big game animal was bear over bait, and you said it was much more sporting than you thought it would be. So I just want to hear more about that.
Yeah. So I'm 38 now, and so I was 37 when I killed a bear, it's because my friend had this bait spot, and he's hunted all manner of things, all manner of ways, and he's eaten more crazy stuff than I have in the past. Although I beat him to coyote, so he had this spot, and he said I could hunt his bait with him. And I similarly had that kind of stigma in my mind about, I'm not gonna hunt over bait. That's not sporting to sit there and have a bear just walk up and shoot it. But at the same time, I was thinking to myself, that's what everybody says about marmots and coyotes too. So why don't I just be open-minded and give it a shot? And so we went up and filled the bait barrel, and we used a small barrel. It's like a lot of people use like a 55 gallon drum. This was more like a 25 gallon drum, and we just put food in the top of it, and the bears would stick their head down in and eat it, instead of having like some people will cut a hole in the bottom of the drum and keep a lid on the top, so the food just kind of feeds out like a rabbit feeder or something. And so we had this spot in the bottom of a ravine with two ridges running east to west above it. And we're kind of at the top of the ravine, but in the bottom, like at the top of it, where it becomes the general mountainside. And it was only about it's a little more than a half mile walk from the car. And so it's really accessible, which is a nice thing when you're baiting, because you have to feed the bait often. Like every few days, you've got to put new food in there, or the bears that are frequenting it won't be frequenting it if it's empty. And then having it year after year, they come there first. Like they know that there's usually food there in April, so they come there in April. And so you've got a good opportunity to keep feeding those bears. And what I learned was that it's just not that easy. It is just about as easy as, or probably harder than, hunting deer from a tree stand. All that having a bait does is tell you where a bear might be sometimes. And usually in the middle of the night is when they go to it. So you've got a game camera there, and you can kind of start watching the deer, watching the bears, just like people have game cameras and they watch the deer and which ones are coming when, and then they go hunt at that time when this deer is likely to be at that spot, and they sit in a tree that gives them a good vantage over that. And that's basically what we did with the deer, or excuse me, with the bear, except that I saw far fewer bears than most people see deer when tree stand hunting. And so I'd been up like 7 days, and I'd sit the morning time. I'd go up, I'd leave home at like 3:30 in the morning, drive 2 hours up there, and then sneak in and sit on top of the ridge overlooking the bait, with my gun, just waiting for bears, and never saw anything. I packed up one day at about 10 a.m. and walked over the ridge, and there was a bear, sitting down in the next ravine, kind of on the edge of the ravine, with the sun just shining in behind him, and his hair was glowing, and the ponderosas around him were glowing orange. And he looked over at me, and we looked at each other for like a good 10 seconds, and then he ran off up the hill. And I thought that was really fun. I could have shot that bear, but it was my first bear to see while hunting, and so I don't know. I just enjoyed the experience of seeing that bear, and I'll never forget the sun coming through the trees and stuff, and just the way he was looking at me. And oh, and then like the sound of an elk running through trees, running through the woods, is like, and there's branches breaking and there's pine needles going, and then deer running off. There might be a branch sometimes break, but mostly it's like that pounding of the mule deer stotting across the hillside, and it's like thump, 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 thump. And then the sound of a bear running through the woods is like this. And they're just so silent. It's amazing.
Yeah, with those big pads and everything.
Yeah, with those huge pads. So I tried to mimic them. I wore my Vibram Five Fingers up there, but I just couldn't be that quiet either. And so finally, the last day, I drove in, and it was a new moon, and I think I'm only going to hunt dark nights next year if I do any bait. I don't know if we're going to do any bait, but I think I'm only going to hunt dark nights because they're less likely to be out moving around. And it was a little cooler. On my way up, I saw these enormous bear prints in the dust on the road, and I don't know, I just felt this tingle of like bareness going on that day. And so I snuck up my ridge, and as I got close to the bait, I looked down in the ravine, and there was a bear in there, and his head is down in the barrel, and he's just eating in and out. He'd come out and sit up for a second and look around and sit there and munch, scratch his chest, and then dive his head back down in and eat some more popcorn. And I got so excited. I pulled my gun out and was just like standing there, and I was like, okay, breathe, breathe easy. And I'm using a 308. And I'm just standing on the hillside. And fortunately, I realized to myself, I'm like, okay, hold on. Offhand is for idiots. And I snuck forward, braced against a tree at least, watched him for a few more seconds in and out a couple of times, and then finally shot him when his head was in the barrel, and he tumbled down into the bottom of the ravine right there. And holy cow, it was a whole different thing. Like I was just, it was my first big game animal, and like the feeling of it was a little unbelievable, and excited and anxious as well, because I didn't see him run off or anything, so I figured he must be just dead there in the bottom of the ravine. And then I went to find him, and 10 hours later, I found him.
Oh, really? 10 hours?
Yeah. It took forever, because he tumbled down into the bottom of the ravine, and I got down there, and there was no blood, there was no hair, there was nothing, and there was no bear. It turns out that right at the bottom of the ravine is like the 18-inch deep track where the creek goes currently. Like in the springtime, there's water running down.
Right.
And so in that little tiny spot is where he tumbled into and then ran off. And so I started doing circles looking for tracks and blood and anything, and I couldn't find anything. Finally, I found a print going up the ravine, and it was in the mud, and it looked like it was crisp. It was a fresh print. And then I found some more. And so I'm following it up the ravine, and I'm like, okay, this makes sense. When I've seen videos on YouTube of a startled bear, they always run uphill. So he's running uphill. I'll go follow this. And it took me, he dove into the tracks led into this brush that was all alders and new pine trees, because it had burned a few years ago. And so there's this really dense growth of new ponderosas and alders that are just, it was like everything I've seen on Alaska, except no Devil's Club. And I'm on my hands and knees going up through this stuff. It took me 3 or 4 hours to go about 500 yards and to circle back down to where I shot him from. And no sign after that. Like, once he entered the bushes, I couldn't find anything. I was kind of following what looked like disturbed leaves and just like worrying the whole time that it was gone. And so I drove back down into town to get a sandwich and call my friend and ask his advice. And he goes, yeah. Oh, and I went to the range down there as well, just to make sure that my gun was on. Like, I was like, did I not even hit him? Cause he tumbled down in. And then I met a guy at the range, and he's like, yeah, bears don't just like tumble. You hit him. You got to go find him. I'm like, I know. So I sighted into the range, and I was bang on, you know, killing pop cans at 100 yards. So I didn't have any doubt that my weapon was right. So I called my friend, and he's like, yeah, normally wounded animals run downhill. Just like, for everybody listening, wounded animals usually run downhill.
Yeah. Well, I was curious when you said that about, I think you said you saw it on YouTube where they run uphill. I have not hunted bears, so I'm totally novice there.
Yeah,
but is there any truth to that for bears specifically? Because, I mean, in general, a wounded animal will run down.
Yeah, no, there's no truth to it at all.
Oh, okay.
But I've often seen, like, bears potentially run faster uphill than they do downhill. Something about the length of their legs.
Okay.
Being, like, it's easier for them to run uphill. And so I've often seen a startled bear takes off running up a hill.
Right.
But not a wounded bear.
Okay.
And so I went back, and our In-N-Out trail, like, when I was hunting, I went up the ridge, but to feed the bait, there's a small trail just in the bottom of the ravine. So I started walking back up that trail, and I was kind of looking around, but then, like, no, just quit wasting time. Go back to the horse and start looking from there. So I started doing zigzags down the ravine, and right about when I got right down to where I said, quit messing around and just go back to the source, there's the bear at the bottom of the ravine, 10 feet off that trail, piled up and bloated and rigor mortis.
Yeah.
And it was only about 60 degrees, so it wasn't terribly hot. But there he was, and man, what a relief.
Yeah.
There was no blood all the way down until right next to his body, where he had like leaned against the hill and tipped over. And my shot ended up being just a little bit far back. And so more into the stomach cavity rather than the cardio, what's it called? The heart cavity,
yeah.
You know, behind the diaphragm instead of in front of it.
Right.
And so he was pretty bloated. And I pulled him up onto the trail to try and find a more flat spot where I could start working on him. And as I did that, the wound started seeping some blood out. And then You can edit this out if it's too gross, but then as I watched, a worm came out of the wound and fell on the ground, writhing around.
Really?
Trichinosis came out of the wound and fell on the ground, winding around. So,
wow.
Trichinosis is a parasite. It's worms. Like, you used to get it from eating raw pork because pork had it. I think the FDA has cleaned it up a lot, so the pork doesn't necessarily have it anymore. But that's why you had to cook pork well done in the past. And I hope my wife isn't listening to this, because while I cooked all the meat well done after that, and you know, we know that that bears may have trichinosis, but like having 100% confirmation that this bear has trichinosis was a little unnerving. And I've got a little video of that too with my phone of it writhing on the ground. So, yeah, I will never treat bear as if it doesn't have trichinosis.
Yeah. Did that deter you at all? Like in the moment where you're like second guessing, like, I don't know what to do with this, you know, or did you just understand, you know, you can take care of it essentially and how you, prepare the meat?
Yeah, no, I understood that I could take care of it. I took a microbiology lab class, and it taught me a lot of things about what you can kill and not kill with cooking and stuff. And I wasn't too worried about it. And when I got home, I reread about how to cook meat to kill trichinosis. You know, you got to go to 160 degrees Fahrenheit to kill it on the inside of the meat, which is like well done. You know, it's like it's done completely. Mm-hmm. I went to 165 on everything I cooked just to be super certain.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that a lot. 165 just to be extra safe.
Yeah.
And you mentioned previously your wife even agrees it's like one of the best meats. I'm curious, do you have a certain go-to for bear preparation, certain recipe, or do you do several things there?
I've done a few different things, and I wish I knew then what I knew now. I'd have treated some of the bear differently. Like I say, that little cookbook from the New Jersey Fish and Game Office had a really good rub recipe with like a certain amount of salt and pepper and brown sugar. Was it sugar? I don't know, something in there. And it was maybe even some nutmeg was in it. And I rubbed that, and then you don't go hot and fast because you need to cook it for a long time to cook the insides without charring the outside. So I cooked it on medium, on a very medium heat on the grill, and for a long time until it got to 165 on the inside. And that was, I mean, it was just so delicious, that first preparation.
What type of cut was that you were doing on the grill?
That was backstrap. Yeah. So that was back, the back loins or whatever.
Yeah. And pretty large sections, or had you butterflied them, or?
I did. What did I do? I didn't know about butterflying. I think I would try that again. It was a small bear. It was not an enormous bear. It turned out to be about a year and a half old is all.
Okay.
Turns out it's a 7-year-old sized bear. As in, my daughter is 7 years old, and when she lays on the, when she lies down on the pelt and stretches her arms out, her arms match the match the pelt just perfectly. And so the back straps were not huge. It's nothing like an elk or even the doe I shot later. And I shared some with my friend who shared me the bait and things, so I didn't end up with a lot of backstrap left. but I had good legs on, like all four legs were good. And I didn't, because I'd shot it in the back, like kind of far back, and it was so bloated, I did a gutless method for the most part, where I made an incision in the hide down the chest and legs to remove the hide. But then I removed all the meat starting from the back, right, like starting from the spine, and I didn't get the tenderloins or the heart. And I kind of regret that. I think I should have gone for the heart now. And I really wanted ribs, but I didn't get ribs. And so there's a lot of meat I didn't take. In Idaho, you're not legally required to take any meat, which I think should be changed. In fact, if anybody here is listening and would like to send me your meat, I would be happy to take your bear meat off. So good. And so I did a lot of slow cooking in the crock pot, and we made like like I took a bunch of meat to both family reunions in the summer, and our day for cooking, everybody ate bear sandwiches.
Yeah.
So that's pretty fun. But I ended up just doing a lot of crock potting. I did also buko with the forelegs, which was really delicious, actually. And I did that yesterday with some antelope, and man, I'll do that every time. It's delicious.
And what is that?
Where you take the shank, the forearm.
Uh-huh.
And instead of removing the meat from the bone, you slice the bone into 2 or 3 inch long sections with the meat on.
Okay.
And then you brown it. And then after browning, you keep it in like a Dutch oven, and you make a sauce. Like a traditional sauce would be like a tomato-based sauce,
right,
with some stock in it, and then braise it for a few hours. The bear I did... I took a can of sweet and sour sauce from my wife's uncle that he gave us, a jar that he made at home, and dumped that in there to braise the bear in the sweet and sour sauce for 3 or 4 hours. And it was awesome. Ended up kind of like glazed tasting and was really good. So I'm a fan of the ossobuco style. It takes like the marrow that's in the middle of the bone ends up coming out and flavoring, really tenderizing the meat quite a lot. Whereas the fat is not good, especially on a bear. Like, everybody who's eaten bear says, oh, it's so greasy, it's gross. But that's because they didn't remove all the fat. And if you just remove every scrap of fat, then it's a really delicious meat.
Awesome. Levi, this has been so good. We didn't even get into your fall seasons, your antelope,
yeah,
and your elk hunt and all that, but we're coming up on time. Yeah, I know. I'm curious though, one thing, you know, I had asked you about before is just kind of some like little lessons you've learned or things like that. And one of the things you mentioned, I just want to conclude with this, is a lesson you learned was to not put the arrows away, to don't unload the gun.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you kind of had some experiences there. So I just want to kind of hear about those stories, but just those simple lessons of like, hey, make sure you're ready type thing. What was your experience there?
Yeah, it was the end of my first day of antelope hunting, which was a bow hunt, which was a total mistake to begin with. I accidentally put in for archery instead of rifle, and then I drew it. And it's not so surprised that I drew it, because it's an unlimited archery tag. And I just marked down the wrong hunt on the sheet. And then learned how to bow hunt. And then my buddy came with me for my first day of bow hunting, and that was the only day he could join me anyway. And we'd been out since sunrise, and now it was sunset, and we were sitting by the car eating our sandwiches in the shade of the car, and we'd unloaded our stuff. I'd set my bow down on the back seat of the car, and I stood up, and suddenly there's the pronghorn that I'd scouted and was hoping to kill walking across the ridge across from us. So I dropped down, Nick grabbed the camera and followed him while I crawled around the car to the door and opened up the door and pulled out my bow, and then crawled back around. And fortunately, he ended up bedding down at the bottom of the ravine between us. And there was one bush, one sagebrush on my hillside that allowed me to sneak in behind that brush between him and with the bush between us, so they couldn't see me. And I ended up killing that antelope, but man, it just would have been a lot simpler if I didn't have to crawl around the car and not slam the door and get the bow out, if I just kept the bow on me. You know, I've learned this as a photographer. Like, as soon as I walk out the door to make pictures, my lens cap is off, and the camera doesn't go in the back of the car. It goes on the console right next to me all the time, because if it's in the back of the car, there's going to be a Siberian tiger walking down the street next to me. It, inevitably, that's what happens. And so you always keep the camera right next to you with the lens cap off, and it doesn't go away until you get home. Like, it's dark and there's no chance of any pictures happening, but it is sitting in my lap all the way home.
Yeah.
And I know this. I don't know why I put my bow away. I was tired and hungry for sure, but so I did end up killing that antelope. And then the same thing happened to me again. I don't know why I have to be an idiot twice, but it was the last hunt of my elk. So I got 3 seasons to hunt elk in the area I chose. I got all of September, and then I got a couple weeks in October, and then I got 10 days in November. And it goes any elk, and then it goes to spike elk in October, and then cow only in November. And so we hiked, we put on 80 miles at least looking for elk this fall, and got into them every time, but just never quite got it done. And then this last day I was out looking for cows, and I'd hiked 12 miles that day and chased them up the hill, and they, like, it was this big ending to my hunt. And then they got away, and I sat down on a log and ate my sandwich and unloaded my shotgun for some reason, thinking it was over and I was going to put it on my back and carry it down. And I mean, even when I go bunny hunting, I don't unload the gun until I'm driving home. And, so I don't know why I unloaded it on the top of the mountain right there, but I'm sitting there eating my sandwich, and these 2 cows walk out of the woods and stand there looking at me for a while. And so I put down my sandwich, reached into my bag, grabbed a shell and put it in the gun, and thought to myself, I should probably grab 2. I thought, nah, I better just hurry. And so brought the gun up. All day long, I had been thinking, if he's within 200 yards, I can, or if she ends up within 200 yards, I can get her, just aim high over the back. It'll drop. I'm shooting a slug, and like the gun is sighted in at 100 yards to nail him. But all day long, I've been thinking just like 8 or 9 inches over the back, and it'll drop into the right spot. And so I raised the gun, took some breaths, stabilized my arms. Like, I wasn't rushing the shot, but I was trying to hurry a little bit. And I fired, and the cow was like 60 yards away. The gun is sighted in for 100. So I should have been aiming low anyway, but no, I was aiming 8 or 9 inches over her back, just like I'd been thinking all day long. Mm-hmm. And it just whizzed over her back. And she stood there, like, after I shot, she stood there looking at me for like a whole second, like 1/1000. And then she ran off. Had I put the second shot in, you know, had I not unloaded my gun, I could have taken the second shot and brought home an elk this fall, but nope, missed it on that one. So yeah, don't put the lens cap on, don't put the camera away, don't empty the gun, don't put the bow in the back, just keep it on you.
Yeah,
it's not worth carrying it all day and then having the one opportunity. So
it is weird how that happens. I mean, when you kind of least expect it at times, is,
yeah,
like you said, that's when it's likely to happen. I mean, I can think of numerous times when we've sat down midday just to take a break in the elk woods and get a snack, and nothing's been happening all day, and then all of a sudden you sit down and shoot, why is, yeah, there a bull 40 yards away right now, and we haven't gotten into anything after hiking miles all day. You know, it's just, it's always that type of scenario for sure.
Well, I mean, in almost every instance like that, it's because you're hunting hangry.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always when you need to have some food in you. Like, I had just run up this mountain after those elk, and my legs were so jello. And I, on my way up, I was thinking, I should probably stop and just take a bite. If I just took a bite, it'd give me some. No, go, go, go. Had I stopped and taken a bite, I probably would have gotten those, the first set of elk, and then definitely wouldn't have missed the second set, because I wouldn't have, my brain would have had thinking power.
Yeah.
So eat and don't put your stuff away.
Yeah. And keep, like, the thing is too, like, have your weapon ready, but keep your head in the ready too. Like, keep your mind, exactly, in the ready that it can happen at any time. Cause it's easy, especially if you get to the end of the day and say you're going back to the truck or something, it's easy to turn your brain off, put your head down and hike out.
Yeah.
And you could very well hike into something. So if you're, you know, if you're not mentally ready to be looking, to be scanning, to, you know, really still be hunting, if it's legal light, but you just don't think something's going to happen, you still need to be hunting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Awesome. Levi, this has been really good. Is there any resources you want to point people to, or like follow you on social, any of that stuff where people can kind of maybe learn more or see what other adventures you get up to, or maybe if they have questions about, you know, cooking a coyote, fire something at you.
Yeah. People can always find me on Instagram. And I've got a lot of weird looking, weird meats cooked up on there. And I'm working shortly to develop a new channel so that I don't have to mix my photography audience with my hunting audience. They don't always overlap.
Yeah.
And so Photo Levi on Instagram. Find me on Facebook, Levi Sim, and I'd be happy to offer any tips for anybody else. It's been like everything I know and have learned has absolutely been from everybody else. And so if I can help anybody else, I'm more than happy to. And and I've got a couple of articles on Hunt 365, which is gunsamerica.com/digest/Hunt365, about my pronghorn hunt, where I also killed a coyote with a bow the same day. There's a couple of articles there. And actually, I think one of my pronghorn recipes is publishing this week, too. It's pretty tasty.
Perfect.
And so, yeah, find me. I'll be around. I'm putting a lot of stuff out. If anyone's going to SHOT Show, I'd love to meet you there. And thank you for a fun opportunity and all the things I've learned from you guys. I mean, I can't distinguish everything I've learned about hunting. So much of it comes from this podcast. So I really appreciate the effort you guys put into it.
That's cool, man. It's definitely not us. It's our guests, which is fun because I'm like you. I've learned so much from doing this show that it's amazing, and it all melds in together as like one big experience. And sometimes it's hard to remember even where you learned something or who said what or what gave you that idea. But it's interesting how much you can take away from it for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that one. Once again, don't forget to check out the giveaway for January. You have a little bit of time left to enter for these prizes, and then we'll roll into a new giveaway in February. Again, thank you so much for tuning in. You can always hit that subscribe button to make sure you don't miss future episodes, and we'll catch you next time.